So we acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spotless, fluffy as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 7, Gold Standard of Gratitude, September 21st, 2013. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode are located on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page or joining the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry. You can find me on Ravelry and Twitter as Sarah Pomegranate. I welcome your suggestions and comments. Welcome to new listeners this week, Laura Nelkin, M.L. Hollywood, Twinset Jan of the Twinset Designs podcast, Knittastic, Maggie Vienna from Austria, and Quilter Knitter, who left a comment on the show blog. She learned many handcrafts when she was a child and is rediscovering and appreciating them now more than ever. She writes that a day is wasted if she doesn't have some fiber in her hands. Quilter Knitter, I couldn't agree more. Two new 5-star ratings and a third review appeared on iTunes this week. Thanks to Elma LC, who said the show is highly recommended and enjoys that it has information and resources while being entertaining too. Thanks for the review, Alma LC. Today's episode features segments titled Ever-Expanding Skill Set and A Little Bit of Learning. But first, I'd like to invite you to participate in a teacher tribute challenge. The Teacher Tribute Challenge is a joint contest I'm hosting, along with Dr. Kelly of U University Podcast. That's EWE University. Dr. Kelly and I began our audio podcast at about the same time this summer, and we were both lucky to have Paula of Knitting Pipeline promote our podcast on her show. If you've been enjoying Yarns at Yin Hu, I encourage you to listen to U University. I think you will like Dr. Kelly's show. One of the things I like about it is that she has an in-the-classroom segment where she does a short lecture on a topic of interests, and she always allows knitting in her classroom while she's giving her lecture, which I think is really cool. So Dr. Kelly and I have been corresponding using Ravelry messages, and we came up with the idea for a joint challenge. That means you can enter to win prizes from U University as well as Yarns at Yin Hu. To enter the contest, think of a meaningful teacher in your life. It may be someone who taught you in a classroom or someone from whom you've learned in a less formal environment. Maybe someone who taught you to knit or sew or quilt or do some other post-apocalyptic skill. When you've thought of that special teacher, write a letter to that person and mail it. Even though we have so many forms of communication available to us today, I think it's important to remember that the handwritten thank you note is still the gold standard of gratitude. There's nothing in the world like receiving one and thinking about how someone really took the time to write something personal. It's something I encourage in my students, a skill that I think it's important we still teach in the classroom, because sometimes children aren't encouraged to do those kinds of things at home. And I think if it doesn't come from home, it really should come from their teachers. So I do thank you writing campaigns, especially around Thanksgiving, and encourage my students to sit down and write a thank you letter. And I provide a whole bunch of very inexpensive, but nicely printed blank thank you cards with funny designs on the front. And teach them how to write a thank you letter. And the number one tip for writing a thank you letter is to tell the recipient something he doesn't already know. And I give the example of, you know, you're at a sleepaway camp and you get a package from grandma and it has a bunch of things in it and some homemade cookies. And your mother has said, you know, you have to write a thank you note to grandma. And so you sit down with huffing and puffing and you write, "Dear grandma, thank you for the cookies. They were good. Love, Adam," or whatever. Well, that's nice. And I'm sure grandma would be thrilled to get that note. But wouldn't it be so much better to let grandma in on something she doesn't already know? She knows she made you the cookies. What she'd like to see is maybe how you enjoyed them. So revised would be, "Dear grandma, thank you for those delicious chocolate chip cookies. Would you believe I stayed up really late in the tent or in the dormitory and enjoyed them with my new friends and we talked about our day swimming in the lake?" Grandma would much more appreciate that thank you note because it lets her see you at camp. It lets her in on information she doesn't know. That's my little secret for writing thank you notes. So you think of this special teacher, you write a thank you note to that person, you put it in the mail, and then you post a tribute to that teacher, either on the Ravelry thread or by leaving a comment on my website under this episode, episode 7. You will have until October 31st to post your tribute in a comment or a reply. Ravelry members can also double dip by posting also on the U University forum. In early November, Dr. Kelly and I will select prize winners. I will be awarding two prizes, one drawn at random from the comments on episode 7 on my website and one from the Ravelry thread. I don't know what the prizes will be because I'll be making two very special purchases at the New York Sheep and Wool Festival, otherwise known as Rhinebeck, in mid-October. One will be a fiber-related prize that I'll gift to one of my Ravelry listeners, and the other will be non-fiber-related. And that will go to someone who posts a teacher tribute on my website. So you have until October 31st. You can double dip, lots of ways to win a prize, and a great opportunity to thank someone who's taught you something meaningful. It's been a beautiful Saturday here at Silver Lake Tea House. Samuel and his band, the Bovine Social Club, are playing in a town not too far from here, but I decided not to tag along. I'll be joining them at Waterloo Village for a festival tomorrow. And so I had the whole day to indulge in the fiber arts. And I worked today on some knitting on my Batad capelet by Stephen West. I also worked on my dye pots, and more with the goldenrod dye, which I'll tell you a lot more about in just a moment. I warped my loom with black sock yarn, which is ready for another project. Finally, I started spinning for the weaving project. I plan to spin a worsted weight yarn, a single, and I'm using some different kind of fiber than I normally purchase from BZB Fibers, which is my favorite Etsy shop for buying fiber in vibrant colors. This is an art bat. I've never spun an art bat before. It's not as smooth a consistency as the combed top that I usually purchase. It has a variety of different kinds of fibers, and I think it has a stellina in it, which is kind of like a copper-colored tinsel thread running throughout. I'm spinning it very lumpy, bumpy, kind of inconsistent, but I think once woven through that black yarn that I've warped onto my loom, it will make a pretty interesting scarf. It just started raining, and you may be able to hear a little bit of the rain on the roof as I record. I'm not sure about that. After a nice day, we're getting some much-needed rain, and that's a good thing. So back to the dye pots. I just took a short break from recording and looked at my Ravelry messages, and I had two messages about my last episode. One from ML Hollywood, who said she wants to try dying and had some questions, was wondering about it. And another from NML Nut, who wanted to know specifically how long can you keep a dye before you use it for yarn or fiber. The goldenrod is out now in this area in the Poconos. It's just starting to decline. And if you wanted to make some dye and use it later, how could you go about that? So I'll try to address that with my lack of experience as I go through this segment and maybe give you some ideas. Well, last week I picked the goldenrod. I stripped the blossoms off of the goldenrod and put them in filtered water, brought it to a boil and simmered it for about an hour, and then I strained that out. That was all I could accomplish last weekend, and so I kept the dye in a pot covered on my porch, which was relatively cool all week. And when I took it into the kitchen this morning, I discovered that some of the vegetable matter had kind of coagulated. There was silt on the bottom of the pot, and I needed to strain it quite a few times through cheesecloth before it looked clear. It also didn't look all that yellow. So I took a little trip down the road and I picked some more goldenrod. I stripped more blossoms off of the stems and I added them to my existing dye with a little bit more water. There's a technique in Chinese cooking, I'm not sure what it's called, but to make an incredibly thick and delicious chicken stock, Chinese cooks will take a chicken carcass, put it in water, bring it to a boil and simmer for many hours, and then remove all of the chicken material, and then you have essentially a stock. You can add vegetables and whatever. But if you just want a chicken broth, you just add the chicken. Well, the Chinese cooking technique is to repeat that with the same stock two more times. So you put another chicken carcass into the pot, and instead of adding water, you add the stock from the previous time, and then you bring it to a boil and simmer for many hours again, strain, and then you do that process yet a third time. And I don't know what made me think of that this morning, but I decided to go and get some more goldenrod and see if I could intensify the color of the dye by adding more. And I think I did. It was a much deeper golden color to the dye by the time I put the second batch of flowers into it. There were some sediments and other things, so in response to NML Nut, I'm wondering if doing a really nice process of filtering it through fresh cheesecloth several times and then maybe freezing the dye would allow you to go through the dyeing process at a later time. I'm not sure, but it could be worth trying if you're interested in just making the dye now and then maybe going through the rest of the process later. I told you in the last episode that I needed to do a bit more research on mordants so that I could prepare my fiber to take the dye. And I decided to use about 100 grams each of a Shetland from Spinners and Farm and a Falkland from Feederbrook Farm. So I had 100 grams of each of those, and I received from Feederbrook Farm a link to a blog called Echoes of a Dream. I will be posting a link to that on my show notes. In Echoes of a Dream, the blogger takes you through the dyeing process and recommends alum and cream of tartar as a mordant. I used 40 grams of alum per 100 grams of fiber, so about 80 grams total, and 35 grams of cream of tartar, or about 70 grams total for the amount of fiber I wanted to dye today. In my research, I found that the word mordant comes from the French, meaning mordre, to bite. And a mordant will help the fiber or what other product you want to dye take on the color of the dye during the process. It's an inorganic oxide that combines with a dye or stain and fixes it into that material. In my case, I was using a pre-mordant or on-chrome because I was treating the fiber before I introduced it to the dye. There's also a post-mordant, which is treating the dyed material. And I might also engage in that process by treating the dyed fiber with vinegar. I think that would constitute a post-mordant. There's also a process called metamordant, which is using the mordant in the dye bath itself. At Yinhu last summer, we did a great deal of work on our porch, and one of the things we needed to do was sand down, we actually had this done professionally, sand down layers of paint that had been applied to the wood floor of the porch. In our case, the porch is about 5 feet deep and extends all around the house. It was painted several times, probably back in the 20s or 30s, and maybe later again in the 60s or 70s, with a number of coats of paint. We don't like the idea of painting a wood floor, and we wanted to stain the floor. The floor is a yellow heart pine, which has a lovely golden color, and we wanted to bring that color out. We wanted to use tung oil, that's T-U-N-G, oil, and in order to get the oil to sit into the wood, we needed to use a mordant. And the mordant that we decided to use was a citrus solution. We used a metamordant technique where we combined the citrus solution with the tung oil and applied it to the wood floor to help it sink in. You let that sit for about a half an hour, and you can see that some of the tung oil is seeping into the floor and some doesn't take, and it sits on top of the wood. And then you go around the porch again and you wipe off all of the remaining solution and oil, because if it doesn't sink in within about a half hour, it's not going to sink in. So I was thinking about all of that today as I was creating my mordant. Luckily, I have a health food store locally, Earthlight, that has a fabulous selection of bulk items, and I purchased both the alum and the cream of tartar there. In separate containers, I measured out the appropriate amount of the alum and the cream of tartar, and I added boiling water to each container and stirred and whisked until it was completely dissolved. Then I added my fiber that was already soaked through with clear water to the mordant, and I brought that pot to a boil very quickly and then down to a simmer and let that simmer gently for about an hour. And I did that while my second round of the goldenrod was simmering away in its pot. When about an hour had passed, I strained the dye solution so that it was clear, and then I poured out all of the fiber in its mordant solution, and I just tried to gently squeeze some of the excess liquid out of the fiber, and then while everything was still hot, I placed the fiber into the dye bath. I brought that dye bath up to a boil and then turned it down to a simmer and let it simmer for about an hour. I took a photograph of the dye pot after I removed it from the heat. I took it outside to take a photograph, and I am currently letting the fiber cool in the dye bath. I read on the blog that that will help enhance the color of the fiber if you let the fiber cool in the dye bath. I'm hoping that that coagulation of vegetable matter that I saw in the dye this morning doesn't happen again. And I'm not sure about how to rinse the fiber. I think I will rinse it with clear water. Maybe I'll rinse it with a vinegar bath and then clear water. I'll have to let you know the next time I record the process I actually use. It's step by step with my first experiment in dyeing. Well, I hope that helps some of you who have curiosities about dyeing fiber with your questions. I also read through some reader comments on Ravelry that using black walnuts to dye results in a lovely brown color, and the dye is so powerful that you don't need to use a mordant. So that could be something in my future if I find some black walnut trees around here. A little bit of learning. Well, last week in the segment called Off the Shelf, I talked about reading The Yarn Whisperer, My Unexpected Life in Knitting by Clara Parks. I'm still enjoying that, and I've been thinking a lot this week about metaphor. So I did a little bit of research on metaphor, and I'd like to share some of my findings with you now. Metaphor is one of our most familiar literary devices through which we describe one thing in terms of another. Metaphor is at work in all fields of human endeavor. There's a book I really enjoy. It was a gift from a former student. It's titled I Is an Other, which is taken from a phrase from Arthur Rimbaud. And the book is by James Geary. I will put a link to it in my show notes. James Geary talks about metaphorical thinking, and he describes it as the human inclination, not just for describing, but for comprehending one thing in terms of another. He says that metaphor shapes our view of the world and the way we view the world. Metaphor is a way of thought long before it is a way with words. So far beyond being just a literary device, an invention of the poet or the writer to be clever or play a little game with words and ideas, metaphorical thinking is actually in our thought process long before it ever makes its way onto the page. Lately, advances in cognitive science have uncovered that metaphor is not a frill or just the territory of poets, but it informs the way we think and how we act and react to all different kinds of situations. In his book, James Geary says that we utter a metaphor every 10 to 25 words, or about 6 metaphors a minute. And the book gives several examples, one of which is a Declaration of Independence, in which the entire first section, which talks about conception and being conceived, is a metaphor that links the birth or formation of the United States to an actual birth. And so a lot of the terms are birth-related and conception-related. It's very interesting to think about things in terms of how many metaphors are being used and how someone who understands all of that metaphor at work has a much greater idea of what is being written about. And someone who doesn't understand all of those metaphors really has to fight for meaning every step of the way. Last week, I shared a section of Clara Parks' memoir in which she compares the trauma and rupture of her parents' separation to a steek. And steeking for non-knitting types is when you create a piece of a garment or something by knitting in the round. And then if you want to go from being in the round, which would be like a pullover if you're thinking of a sweater, to being a cardigan, where you have a zipper and you have a split up the front, then you actually cut into your knitting. And doing so is called steeking, or forming a steek. A metaphor can save time. And the book gives the example of metaphors looking like equations, x equals y. One of the examples that's given, and this is for you, Prairie Piper, is from the Scottish poet Robert Burns. My love is like a red, red rose. When we use a metaphor and link X to Y, we try to make Y something that the reader will have a lot of associations with. So in the case of my love is like a red, red rose, love is this abstract concept. It's something that's very difficult to describe and to understand. The red, red rose, however, is something concrete and tangible, something that we have a lot of different associations with. And so the expectation is for the reader or the listener to bring all of the associations he has with Y to the understanding of X. My love is like a red, red rose. When a poet or an author puts out that initial equation, X equals Y, somewhere at the beginning of the piece, and then continues to play on that comparison throughout the piece, as Thomas Jefferson did in the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, that's said to be an extended metaphor. Many poems, many short essays are essentially one extended metaphor that plays out over the duration of the piece. Metaphors that are overused, however, and I think My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose falls into this category of being overused or used in frivolous situations, can lose their freshness and lose their luster and become cliches. Another thing at work in Robert Burns, the Robert Burns example, is this use of like or as. He writes, "My love is like a red, red rose." A comparison using like or as is known as a simile, and often the simile is dismissed as being an inferior type of metaphor, which isn't necessarily the case, because similes can be as fresh and new and bulging with meaning as a metaphor can. For some reason, overused metaphors that have become cliches are most offensive when they're being used in some romantic situation. It seems incumbent upon the romantic poet to come up with fresh and interesting metaphors, and if you use anything that's been done before, somehow the resulting communication loses its luster and loses its meaning, and then maybe that means that the romance is fading or the recipient doesn't react in a way that the writer imagines. Aristotle said that metaphorical thinking was a sign of genius, since it implied intuitive perception of the similarity between dissimilar things. And the similarity between dissimilar things, I find, is a key to creating fresh and interesting metaphors. The two things that are being compared need to be quite dissimilar, or dissimilar on many levels, except for the one important way they are similar, in order for a metaphor to work well. If you don't have dissimilar things being compared in your metaphor, you can get bad metaphors. And rather than finding these disappointing, I find bad metaphors really delightful. Sometimes teachers put collections of things that students write that are very funny online. There is a book somewhere of really bad metaphors that a poet teacher collected over the years. I forget where I've seen this, but a couple that I remember are, "He was as tall as a 6-foot-tall tree." And even better, "Her eyes were green circles with black dots in the middle." I think those are some great examples of metaphor and simile gone wrong. And I think looking at poor examples can be instructive in thinking about what makes a good metaphor. The final thing I investigated about metaphor is that it's the key to studying etymology or word history, to find out how one word developed from another word and how meanings evolved over time. It's really important to have an understanding of metaphors and how they work. If I get too much into etymologies, I'll totally geek out. And like I said, this is a little bit of learning. So I think I'll end our discussion on metaphor now. Today's quote is brought to you courtesy of Goodreads. I would maintain that thanks are the highest form of thought, and that gratitude is happiness doubled by wonder. G.K. Chesterton. Thank you for listening. The music in today's episode is So Wheat, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Chris DeLong and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves are down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Cousins, a bird out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's ever get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.